This is All Things Considered on 90.1 WABE. I'm Dennis O'Hare. The American Cancer Society this month celebrated its 100th anniversary. It has seen remarkable changes in the diagnosis, treatment, and survival rate for cancer in that time. Dr. John Ceferin is, you might say, an American Cancer Society lifer. He is the CEO, has been CEO of the Cancer Society for 21 years. He's been involved with it since 1972. He joins us in his office. Dr. Ceferin, welcome. Good to have you, and congratulations.
Thank you so much. It's an exciting time for the American Cancer Society.
You've seen dramatic reductions in the rates of so many cancers just in the last few years, prostate cancer, breast cancer, some of the ones where prevention has been emphasized so heavily, lung cancer. Melanomas, though, skin cancer, continue to rise. What's the difference? We certainly hear a lot about that as well.
Well, cancer, of course, is many different diseases, at least 200. And so the fact is that bottom line is we get too much exposure to sunlight. And as a result of that, you're at a higher risk of getting malignant melanoma. But you're right. The good news is we're making progress on literally all fronts. We just were able to announce in January the first ever 20% reduction in age-standardized cancer mortality rates in the United States. Never happened before. And that means about 1.2 million people will celebrate a birthday this year that wouldn't have had a chance to do that if the death rates had stayed the same. What is even more important that people understand is that that makes a huge difference in quality of life, meaning by that 20% reduction yields the American public a $10 trillion value.
How close are we to vaccines, since we're talking about different diseases here, vaccines or other preventive medicines for cancer, looking into the future?
We're so close that we've got some. So just literally within the last 24 hours, the World Health Assembly, the 66th World Health Assembly, has announced a plan, and one of the indicators is to increase the number of people who get vaccinations for the human papillomavirus, which is a major cause of cervical cancer. So we know the following, and that is that we're in the era of targeted therapies, where in the old days, chemotherapy was cytotoxic drugs. They made the patient very sick. You try to give them enough to kill the cancer, but not the patient. It's a whole new era where we have targeted therapies and things like vaccinations that can keep people from ever getting the cancer in the first place.
One of the questions about that, though, has been the expense, because we have insurance policies that are covering less and less while the costs continue to rise. Are people going to be able to afford these therapies?
Well, that's a very important question, and it is a difficult time. There's no question but what some brand new drugs are so expensive that they price people out of the market. However, I'm optimistic about the future for the following reason, and that is with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, various preventive things are mandatory to be covered. And as these new preventions come along, I think that will force the price down, but the volume will make up for it. And obviously, cervical cancer is no longer a major cancer threat in America, although some people get it, but that's those who fall through the safety net. But globally, it's still a major form of cancer death that doesn't have to happen. We've made so much progress that when I'm asked what keeps me awake at night, it's not, will the American public continue to support us? It's most cancer suffering and most cancer deaths in America today are needless based on what we know today.
You mentioned the Affordable Care Act. There is a drive to repeal it. You're not a political organization, but you have taken stands on areas of public policy. If the Affordable Care Act is repealed in any part, would that make it more difficult for people to afford the therapies we've been talking about for the future?
I think it probably would. I think it is inevitable that we will build out a new and better healthcare system, whatever we wish to call it. It would be difficult to build one as bad as the one we just left. And so I'm optimistic. It isn't going to be easy. It's such a huge bill and so complicated that there are bound to be bumps in the road, but they can be fixed.
What would be your recommendations if you could write a prescription? I mean, you're a PhD, not an MD, but if you could write a prescription, what would be the ways that would be the most urgent to fix it?
I think without any question that the new healthcare system has to be built around the centerpiece of prevention. We have an opportunity, Dennis, to be the healthiest nation in the world, but we are not. When compared with 16 other comparator countries, we are last or next to last on 10 variables that reflect the health of the citizenry. Yet we live in a country where 95% of neonates are born healthy. Many, not all, but most are genetically programmed to stay healthy through a normal human lifespan. So the point is, if we actually get serious about taking care of our kids and allowing them to grow up healthy, then it assures not only their quality of life and length of life, but it assures the economy. The number one health, disease, and disability threat of the 21st century is cancer and non-communicable diseases. The good news is we know a lot about what to do about them, but we have to take action now. And so we're saying let's finish the fight against cancer, and we can't do that by being quiet. We got to make noise and take action.
You mentioned mandates. Are they, for you, an essential part of any prevention program that would be not just for kids but for anybody?
Yes, I think it's so important that we recognize that we have to have everybody covered. I think a very important decision was made by policymakers long ago, and that was we are not going to have just a public healthcare system, that it was going to be a private-public mix. And once you make that decision, then it's important to find ways in which everybody gets covered, because we know that our biggest threat right now is disparities, that many people are suffering and dying from cancer needlessly simply because they don't have the coverage they need to get the treatment they need. The truth is most of the suffering and most of the death from cancer is needless based on what we know to do. So what we want to do, what the American Cancer Society is trying to do, is make sure everybody can benefit from the successes we've seen. Many of those successes have been based on research funded by public money.
By public money meaning government money or donations from the public?
It's really both, but the lion's share of the funds are government money. And so people like for the Congress to fund the National Institutes of Health, the National Cancer Institute, and we're getting some wonderful results from that in terms of finding answers to very complex questions. And the key is for us to get those answers and solutions to the bedside and to the clinic where it can actually make a difference in whether a person lives or dies.
Of course, you know the political debate, not only about whether government should fund everything it does, but whether government funding is the most efficient way to make it happen. You're saying, I think, that you believe it is.
I think that there's no question but what our nation has essentially the premier biomedical research center in the world. There are other very good ones, but none as of the size and stature of it. But it is important for the private sector to be engaged. The American Cancer Society is so proud because we made a major commitment to cancer research in 1946. And as a result of that, we have now funded some 46 beginning cancer investigators that went on to win the Nobel Prize. No one else has ever done that. And it's so important because right now the government pay line, they call it, is so low that many young investigators simply can't get a grant unless they can get it from the American Cancer Society. So we have targeted beginning investigators, and it's paying off.
On the question of research, there have been some incidents, not necessarily in cancer, but in all sorts of medical research, psychiatric and medical research, where the research was funded by some of the companies that would benefit from it. How concerned are you about that? And is that something that is going to become more of an issue in the future?
Well, I'll say this. I think we're much better today in terms of transparency and reporting conflicts of interest. It's inevitable that occasionally there will be a conflict of interest. One of the things that the American Cancer Society has been very proud of is that we are independent of the government and we are independent of the private sector. And so we can actually say, here's the best evidence and here's what we think is in the best interest of the person facing cancer. In some cases, other people may be more conflicted, and I think the results of their research need to be looked at all the more closely to make sure that there isn't some bias there. But I think I've seen in just the last few years, I think, a much improved disclosure of any potential conflicts of interest, and that allows the person reviewing the results to determine whether that conflict of interest was too significant or not.
Some of the researchers, though, have ended up plugging, if you will, and this has been rare, but it has happened, plugging the very therapies that they found were effective.
Well, that's where we have to be careful in terms of plugging new therapies, because we want to make sure that it is truly better than anything else available. And in some cases, it's very hard. The evidence is pretty light that it's a dramatic improvement over something that's more commonly available.
How do you screen for conflicts of interest? Because you get results, reports, studies all the time. How do you vet them?
Well, we have a whole process for establishing various, for example, screening guidelines. And we make sure that we have true experts around the table and that they report any conflicts. If they have them, we try to avoid any of them. And our record, I think, is about as good as anybody's, is avoiding any place where it would appear that the panel had been co-opted because they've got people who've already made up their mind and don't want to look at the evidence. So we're a very evidence-based organization, have been for at least a half a century, and we'll stick with that because we have I've had people say, John, you know, you're not stepping out far enough on this issue, but I say, well, wait a minute, we're the American Cancer Society, and a little like E.F. Hutton, if we say something, people are going to listen. So we wait until we've got the evidence, or we simply say we're not in a position to make a statement on that right now because we don't have the evidence. And interestingly, over the past half century, we've never had to go back to the public and say, whoops, we got it wrong. we thought screening mammography was working, but it's not, or whatever. It does work. It doesn't work as well as we think it should. Hopefully we'll have something better, but until we do, it is an important way to reduce one's risk of dying of breast cancer.
You mentioned government funding a while back. Here in Georgia, just to take one example, and Georgia's hardly alone in this, Georgia, one of many states that got settlement with the tobacco companies. The money comes in, but it doesn't go to prevention programs. It goes to the general fund. Mm-hmm. Have you talked to officials here in Georgia and in other states about that? And does it bother you that the money that has at least a stated purpose of saying we want to prevent cancer ends up going to shrink budget shortfalls in states like Georgia?
No, I think monies like tobacco settlement monies need to be spent on prevention and solving the problem that tobacco creates. And it's a miscarriage of stewardship and good policy when something else happens to it. The wonderful part is the progress we've made. We know that tobacco education efforts work today. We know ways in which we can reduce prevalence, especially in children. And so for the money not to be spent in the way that it should be is just a miscarriage of stewardship and good public policy. It's a very key point. We have the Prevention Fund in the Affordable Care Act. For the first time in the history of the nation, you had actual resource being placed in it, and we know if they are spent in the way that is intended, we will get results and become over time the healthiest nation in the world. If they're not, then a whole other scenario plays itself out. One thing that's so important is that there are so few things in life we know for sure. But one of the things we know for sure, that there will be a tsunami of cancer and non-communicable diseases over the next 20 years if we don't intervene. And it's not maybe. Aging is a global phenomenon, and so we know we'll be seeing these diseases, and we know things we can do to intervene now to reduce. So that's why it's important for the World Health Organization to follow up on the UN high-level meeting to set 25 by 25, to set the goal, which is now official, to reduce cancer and non-communicable diseases by 25% by the year 2025.
Have you spoken to officials in Georgia about since you're here, about the tobacco settlement issue?
Yes, we have, and we will continue to do that because it's a huge opportunity, not just in Georgia, but in every state, to reduce the amount of tobacco prevalence, and we can measure the results from that in a timely fashion, and it's particularly important to protect children. The tobacco industry is really an abuser of children. And they're marketing their products, causes many of them to get addicted. And the earlier they get addicted, the more likely they are to be a lifetime smoker and be killed by the product.